Welcome to Turf Nets Renovation Report, brought to you by Gall Preservations and Jacobson. Here's your host, John Kiger.
Hey, guess what? Surprise, surprise. It's not John Kiger. This is Dave Wilbur, one of the TurfNet bloggers, and doing a little bit of a different duty here today and hosting this amazing opportunity to get to speak with two real professionals. We're going to talk about Spring Lake Golf Club and the renovation and all the stuff that's going on there. I am so looking forward to doing this because, I don't know, I just have some real heart ties with a few of the things that we're going to talk about today. So I want to introduce Josh Rager and Trip Davis. Josh is the golf course superintendent at Spring Lake, and Trip Davis, the golf course architect who's recently completed a pretty major restoration effort there. So let me just start with you, Josh. Hello, and how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, listen, Josh, if you would, in just a couple of quick sentences, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm originally from Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania. It's a small town in central PA. My dad was in the Air Force growing up, so moved around some, but, central PA will always be home. So always wanted to go to school at Penn State. I was fortunate enough to see that through. Graduated from Penn State in 2003. Got into the golf course business. A buddy of mine, when we were in school, did a summer at a golf course, and I was pretty undecided about what I wanted to do with myself. So he kind of told me what it was all about, and I figured I'd give it a shot. So went to the Ag Sci building there at Penn State and talked to the people I needed to speak to, and decided to give it a shot. So I actually started taking turf classes before I worked on a golf course, which is a little bit backward, probably.
I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, I played a lot of golf when I was in high school and things. Being from that area, it's about an hour and a half outside of Pittsburgh as well. So Oakmont was always a name of golf that I knew that I figured if I could go work there, that would be something that would probably be good for me in the long run. And I was fortunate enough to do an internship there as my first internship. Subsequently went back for another internship and then worked there for about a year and a half after I graduated college for John Zimmer's, who's still at Oakmont. I learned what it's like to take care of a golf course and have it in U.S. Open condition every day. That's what's expected at Oakmont, and that's what they bring each and every day. It teaches you a certain work ethic, and it was just a great place to start my career. From there, in 2004, I became the first assistant at Weeburn Country Club in Darien, Connecticut, under Doug Drugo, who's also still at Weeburn. Doug was actually the first assistant at Oakmont, so that transition for me was pretty seamless. We just basically took the cultural practices and kind of the mentality that we had at Oakmont, just plugged it right into Weeburn, and we were able to really turn around the golf course health-wise and playability-wise, in a really short amount of time. I was also lucky enough to do a master plan restoration at both Oakmont and at Weeburn. $1 million-plus projects both places. Tons of work, bunkers, tees, you name it, tree removal, we did it. And then in 2011, on January 1st, I took the job here at Spring Lake Golf Club. We haven't really looked back, we've been busy every year that I've been here. It's been really a great educational thing for me, just learning, now being a superintendent, all the things that go into it that I maybe didn't see, some of the behind-the-scenes stuff before with projects like this specifically.
Exactly.
And then the best part of my story, I have a beautiful wife, Valerie. Together we have a happy and healthy son, Jacob. He's about 15 months old now. And we have two dogs, Mickey and Bree, so it's a busy house.
Wow. Well, cool. And I'm sure that Valerie appreciates you speaking up for her being the important part. Good job, buddy. That's going to get you a long way, I think. So, all right, well, thanks for that introduction. And we're going to get back to talking about Spring Lake a little bit. But first, I want to get to you, Trip Davis. And Trip, The funny part of how the world works today is that I'm actually about 3 miles away from one of your projects in Colorado called Grand Elk. I'm actually looking out over the golf course right now, and I don't know if you remember walking Grand Elk with me, Trip, but during the construction, but I had a wonderful time out there with you, so it's really special to have a chance to have you here today and look out over your golf course while I'm talking to you.
Well, how's it look?
Well, you know what? It looks good, and one of the locals stopped me in town the other day to talk grass with me for a second and told me that that the golf course is playing real good, and they've had a lot of wet weather, but he said that the place is good. So Trip, can you just give us a brief bio of you and tell us who Trip Davis is?
Well, I got into the business after having played a lot of golf. I grew up around the game and played competitively when I was younger and ended up going to the University of Oklahoma to play golf. And while I was at Oklahoma, it's still one of the top 15 programs in the country, but it was when I was there, we had a lot of really good players. I played with Todd Hamilton and Grant Waite, Craig Burks, and oddly enough, after all those guys left, my senior year, we won the national championship. And it was enough to make me think I was a good player, and so I tried to play professionally for a little bit, about a year and a half, and I realized how good I wasn't. Pretty much, I'd wanted to be a golf course architect when I was a kid, and so I went back to school and got my master's degree in landscape architecture and started my own firm basically right out of school. I had some opportunities to go work for some of the big names, and because I knew a lot of people in the golf business, I was given some opportunities and thought I would at least try that and see if, you know, what it was like out on my own. You know, 21 years later, here I am.
Wow.
You know, not working for someone, there was learning curves in certain ways, but I think it also helped me because a lot of the things, instead of being told what was the right thing to do, I had to learn it and figure it out on my own. So that was good. And a lot of what I've done over my career has been renovation, especially starting out, because no one was going to really give me the chance to do a new course when I was just starting on my own. And so I've continued through with that, and we've evolved into doing some restoration as well. So really for the last 10 years, a lot of what I've done is renovation, restoration. Grand Elk being one of the new courses that I did get to do. You know, we've done a handful of new courses, and fortunate I actually got to do one in China that opened last year and did one in Mexico. But for the most part, we've done renovations and restoration. I live in Norman, Oklahoma. After I finished playing college golf, I stayed there. My wife is from Oklahoma, and we have two daughters, Mary and Maggie, that are 18 and 16, thought about moving to Dallas one time, and I came home on a Friday night after we had kind of decided that we were going to move to Dallas and realized that Norman was not such a bad place to live. So it's a little bit harder to travel, but it's a good spot to be in.
Thanks, Trip. I mean, I love the part of your story where you just did it a little bit different and didn't go work for, you know, one of the big names and said, man, I'm going to do this myself. I mean, that took a lot of courage. Huh?
Well, it was, you know, at the time it was, the golf industry was, you know, this was 1994, the golf industry was booming.
Yeah, getting into the boom time, exactly. Yeah.
Right, so, you know, it was a little easier because it was a little bit of work, and it was a little easier for me because I knew a lot of people in the golf industry. You know, I wouldn't recommend that to anybody today because it's a lot more difficult. We've seen a lot of attrition in the American Society of Golf Course Architects even.
We're going to get to in a little bit, we're going to get to talking a little bit about the future here, and I want to hear from you on that and all that. So let's back up just a little bit and talk about Spring Lake. Josh, I was wondering, first of all, I had a chance to get on the Spring Lake website, and whoever wrote the history of Spring Lake there, man, I'll tell you, what a great piece of writing that is. If you guys Google Spring Lake Golf Club in New Jersey and want to read, you know, it's pretty lengthy, but it's a great piece about how George Thomas was involved and then Tillinghast. But, you know, Josh, maybe you can just talk a little bit about the club and what it feels like there today, you know, what your membership is like, you know, that kind of stuff. What's happening now at Spring Lake, as well as some history, if you would.
Sure. You know, just to start off, I mean, it's just a dynamic location that the golf club is in. For people that aren't familiar with New Jersey and the Jersey Shore, we're about a half mile from the Atlantic Ocean and the Jersey Shore. You know, we're an hour south of New York City, hour and a couple minutes, maybe. We're about an hour east of Philadelphia. So it's a pretty dynamic spot. It's really a nice place to be. You know, the membership itself, strong membership, full membership with a 50-plus person waiting list, I believe, you know, which here in the grounds department, we take a lot of pride in that because we think, you know, this is a golf club. We don't have a swimming pool. We don't have tennis courts. We have golf. So the fact that there's a pretty extensive waiting list, I think, kind of speaks to what we're doing each and every day, which is a really positive thing. You know, laid back membership, I'd say, you know, being this close to the beach, it's maybe a little bit different than what I was used to at Oakmont and even at Weedburn up in Connecticut. You know, I would say it's a more laid back as a whole, younger group too. Don't get me wrong. We have a big, like our senior day on Wednesday is always, you know, it's jam packed, but I think the membership over the last, you know, 5 to 8 years has really, gotten a bit younger. The club itself was founded in 1898. It was originally 9 holes. It was a couple yards down the road from where it's at now. And then in 1910, they had George Thomas, as you said, come in and do the original design of the golf course. It was actually the last course he worked on the East Coast and the only one he ever did in New Jersey, which is pretty neat. And then
quickly
– sorry, go ahead. Pretty quickly after that, being the only course in New Jersey, I think it's pretty dynamic, and the last one on the East Coast, I know he went to, you know, some of the bigger courses, Riviera, LA Country Club, you know, some of the big ones after, but just adds to the history here. And then A.W. Tillinghast was brought in, you know, relatively soon after, 1918, you know, to kind of do a renovation or restoration, if you will, of the golf course, then. You know, from like 1940 to 1947, the club had a professional event. I don't think it was like recognized by the PGA or whoever the governing bodies were at the time, but it was a professional event. And they had it for 7 years, at least, where they had like touring pros come in. Some of the biggest names were here: Gene Sarazen, Byron Nelson, Sam Snead, Craig Wood, Walter Hagen. They all played golf here at Spring Lake Golf Club. And actually, the event was called the Spring Lake Invitational, and it was known for being one of the biggest purses there was in golf at the time, which is why it attracted so many big names, I think.
Such a common thing during that period of time. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly, yep. You know, the club's had 2 New Jersey State Opens, and actually in 1981 they had the USGA, the Senior Women's Amateur Championship. So it's a pretty storied history. Like I said, it's, you know, it's in a really dynamic spot. If you've ever been to the Jersey Shore, it's just a beautiful part of the country, honestly. You know, it's a great place to be.
Down the shore is what everybody always said to me. Make sure you say down the shore. So
that's it.
Well, cool. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how you guys got married up. Tripp, can you tell us about the selection process? I mean, how did you, a guy from Norman, Oklahoma, get involved with a place on the Jersey Shore?
Well, I'd been doing work in the Northeast. In 1999, I actually was playing in an amateur event. I only played professional golf for about a year and a half. And when I started back to school, I really didn't play much. But I got my amateur status back in about 95, I think, and started playing a little bit of amateur golf and ended up playing in a four-ball event that's at Wingfoot called the Anderson Memorial. And guy was sitting next to it at lunch one day, started talking about how an architect had come in and ruined the greens there, and that golf course design was kind of a farce. And he looked over at me and said, "You're a golf course architect, aren't you?" And I said, "I'm starting out." And so he, out of shame, I think, took me down to Engineers Country Club on Long Island. And I ended up, I still work there today. I've been working with them ever since. And that's how I kind of got involved in working in the Northeast. And worked in a lot of places around. One of the places that I worked at was Whippoorwill, up in Armonk, New York. For whatever reason, there are a lot of members there that have some New Jersey ties, and then I also knew a guy named Mike Stamberger. Mike is a good amateur player that I'd played some amateur golf with, and he told me about it, and I went up and met with him. One of the more extensive interviewing processes I've been through. They interviewed a lot of different guys, and luckily was selected to do the work. And about the same time, I was selected to do a master plan for Rumson Country Club, about 30 minutes north of there. And so the ties made a lot of sense. I'd done some Tillinghast work before, too. So that was part of one of the reasons I think I was selected.
What a cool thing. And I noticed on your list of projects, Deepdale, and so, definitely some cool experience in the Northeast. Exactly. So, okay. So what I want to talk to you guys both about right now is, all right, so Tripp, you've been through the lengthy selection process, and now you have to take this amazing golf course, amazing old golf course that, like every old golf course has been messed with a little bit over time, and you probably had to educate Josh, the membership, a greens chairman, a whole bunch of people about, and I was hoping that you'd talk to us a little bit about that process today.
Well, every project that we do when we're doing a master plan, especially when there's a restorative element that's desired by the club, you want to recapture some of the history. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, the history and having a golf club that's designed by both George Thomas and Tillinghast is a pretty neat thing. And so it's a good story to tell for the membership. It certainly helps with the membership having some pride in the club because of those factors. And then the other thing is that those guys were pretty good at what they did. And, Thomas did a good job with routing the golf course. And then when Tillinghast came in, he enhanced it a lot with the way that he did the greens that he worked on, some of the bunker layout. And so they did good work. And so going back to what they did is – both of historic value to the membership from a pride standpoint, and there's good things from a playing standpoint to pull from that. Now, obviously, you have to adapt it to the modern game because we play a totally different game than they did in 1918.
That's a sticky word, that word modern, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
Tripp, that word modern is a really sticky word, isn't it, when you're talking about a property like that?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you're wanting the golf course when you're done with it to feel old in a lot of respects, but you also want it to be relevant for the modern player. There's a lot of our older golf courses, and we hear it all the time, how they're not relevant anymore because Bunkers were put out at 230 yards from the tee, and the better players now blow it by it. And, the average player usually ends up in the bunkers that were meant for the better players, 50, 60 years ago. And so it's a balancing act. And what we focused on at Spring Lake was, in part, restoring some of the things that were original that have relevance today. Part of it was stylistic, because they had had some work done there that was not perfectly in keeping with the original style, especially that Tillinghast would have left. Tillinghast, when he did Spring Lake, did more of a grass-faced, steep-faced bunker with more flat bottoms of sand. And over time, they had done some work that took away the steepness of the grass face. So that was important to get back for a couple of reasons. One, just the look of it, and also the playability, so the balls would get into the bunkers. And from a stylistic standpoint, we had something kind of unique we could do there, because Thomas was more known for sand lines that moved a little bit. When Tillinghast did his grass-faced bunkers, the sand lines were pretty straight, pretty much, to the bottom. While Thomas, when he did Riviera, LA Country Club, Bel Air, he created more movement in his lines, a little more interesting. And so we kind of married those two concepts together.
Uh-huh.
And with most of the clubs that we work with, a lot of these things have to do with maintenance function. It's not always about historic restoration. And, Josh can speak to some of that, but, when he got there was some, the bunkers were a little more difficult to maintain. He had to repair washouts on a regular basis on, most of the bunkers. And there were no liners in the bunkers, so he had contamination issues he was dealing with. And so that was kind of the emphasis for the movement towards doing the project, in large measure was the emphasis on the master plan. But when you're doing renovation work that repairs and or helps the infrastructure of the golf course be more maintainable, more sustainable, there's nothing that really keeps you from doing it in such a way that has more of a historic bend to it than just creativity and doing your research. And so was the emphasis that Spring Lake was to restore the style, incorporate the style of both of those architects to be interesting, and then address some of the function issues, make it a little more maintainable. So good.
That's good. Well, guys, we're going to take just a short break here. We've got a couple of great sponsors that are sponsoring the Renovation Report on TurfNet, Golf Preservations and Jacobson. And we've just got a quick word from both of those guys, so hang tight. And when I come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about your working relationship, the two of you. Talk about some of the choices that you made with bunkers.
From green drainage to sod work, Golf Preservations can handle your project with ease and give you the peace of mind to know the professionals are caring for your valuable golf course assets. Visit golfpreservations.com or call 606-499-2732 to talk to us directly about your next project. TurfNet's Renovation Report is brought to you by Jacobson, makers of the all-new Truckster XD. The Truckster XD is a true heavy-duty utility vehicle and has the largest standard payload capacity in its class. It features a rugged and durable box made from thick 12-gauge steel and is paired with the most powerful gas Kubota engine available. The all-new Jacobson Truckster XD is designed to make your next renovation, or whatever your next project is, easier.
All right, well, welcome back to the Renovation Report here on TurfNet. And, we're just so excited again today to have Tripp Davis, golf course architect, and Josh Rieger talking about Spring Lake Golf Club in New Jersey. Just already some great information coming out. And, guys, I really appreciate you taking time to do this with us today. We have a lot of ground to cover and not a lot of time left, so what I want to do now is get to something that I think a lot of the people listening here really want to hear. And that has to do with the relationship between the golf course superintendent and the architect when we're doing restoration and renovation work. So, Josh, I'd love it if you'd talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to get Tripp to chime in as well. I know how hard this work is. I've been out there, and I've still got the dirt under my fingernails, you know, from many different sides of it. So I sure would love to hear about how you guys work together at Spring Lake and what some of your challenges were and what some of your successes were.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, the relationship between the superintendent and the architect is the most important one during something like this. You know, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of people involved, but we're basically the two people that, you know, the architect's going to design the thing, and he has his architectural intent, and, you know, he wants a golf course and holes to play a certain way. And, you know, from the superintendent's standpoint, I have to be able to maintain it. You know, I just feel like once everybody's gone after a project's done like this, everything, you know, falls back onto the grounds department and onto the superintendent. It's got to be something that's viable and, you know, something that's maintainable. You know, I know Trip kind of hit on it before with a project like this. We definitely had some areas that became, you know, harder to maintain, if you will, or just a little bit more labor intensive. But, you know, that all comes like with good planning to be ready for stuff like that. And I think that's okay, where Tripp and I did really well.
Let's talk about that. And I don't want to interrupt you too much, Josh, but let's talk about something specific around that. And that has to do with the bunkers. And I looked at some pictures of your bunkers, you know, and my assumption is that those bunkers have a lot more movement in them and all that sort of stuff than they did before. So how did you guys work that strategy out for the bunkers? And, you know, how did you kind of speak up about, hey, can I maintain this or not? And then Tripp, you know, I'm going to ask you how you talked about that whole idea of having artistic representation there. So let's talk specifically about your bunkers and that.
Okay. I think the biggest thing was communication, just like in anything else. I mean, right off the bat, when we started talking about bunkers, Tripp basically said, these bunkers are, during the last, there was a restoration project done how many ever years ago, 20-some years ago, and they basically made the bunkers so that they were much less steep, so you could take a side blinder around everything. Very low maintenance, you know, not much labor needed, so to speak, type of thing. So it was going to be a drastic change. Now, you know, just because of where I've been and where I've worked, I've seen it all. I've seen fly mowers and hover mowers, whatever you want to call them. Those things are such a pain in the rear end. So there's a little trepidation at first, but it's what the golf course needed to get, you know, all the bunkers pushed back in towards the greens and the fairways more to bring them back in play, and the steeper faces, that's all part of it. So, we communicated it, we talked about it, we had an idea. I had an idea of what I wanted to do maintenance-wise once the bunkers were built to get away from fly mowers and things like that. I have a very good mechanic who kind of engineered and fabricated some things, and you know, we have a system now, and really it takes us a couple extra guys to do the work, like mowing specifically around the bunkers. It might take us two extra people than what it used to, but it takes us the same amount of time. So
Did you hand-rake bunkers before the restoration here, Josh?
We did. Yep.
Okay. So you didn't have that change to worry about. You weren't going all the way from hand-rake to machine.
No, because when I start, like, I was still pretty new, so, you know, I was, like, very, I guess, intense is the word, and we were hand-raking bunkers. You know, we weren't trying not to cut corners, things like that.
Got it. Okay, so, Tripp, if you would, for a minute, just talk about your interactions with Josh in regards to some of these, you know, that maintenance thing, the mobile contours and whatnot, and how that worked with you guys and with your shaper as well.
Well, there's somewhat of a balancing act. I mean, you know, it's any project that we go into, we somewhat have to assess what the capabilities of the maintenance crew, the superintendent are going to be, not only from a dollar standpoint, but from a, you know, a philosophy perspective. I mean, you know, it needs to be something that will work long term. I mean, you know, that carries to bunker design, to grass selection, and so forth. So, you know, part of my job is reading what the superintendent is capable of, and what gave us the freedom in a lot of ways to focus on the artistic side of what we were doing, the historic side of restoration, is the fact that Josh is a very capable superintendent. You know, he understands how to make what we do work, and we obviously, you know, we're cognizant of what he was trying to do, but, you know, and what he was going to need, what he was going to be left with. And, but the fact that he has such a good grasp of you know, and having worked at Oakmont and at Weavern and just his general, you know, opinion and, you know, his attitude towards we're going to make it good, you know, in whatever way we have to, really freed us up to do the work that we really wanted to do. You know, we run into occasion on jobs where the superintendent and or the maintenance budget, whatever it may be, just simply won't allow for a little bit more intensive maintenance. But in this case, we were given the ability to, you know, be a little freer and you know, not only during the construction was Josh good at that. I've never seen a golf course after we've done with it that, you know, even just a couple of months after we were done with it, looked like we were never there. I mean, that's the biggest compliment I can ever pay to Josh.
Wow.
Really any superintendent is how well they do is growing it in and making it fit. And he's done an outstanding job. I mean, I was there, I think it was 1st of May, wasn't it? Or end of April, wasn't it, Josh?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, and when I was there, I mean, you know, we had literally just started finishing some of the work up, and there were very few places where you could see that we'd actually been there. You know, from my perspective
cool.
And from most golfers' perspective, I know Josh well enough that Josh probably still sees things that he doesn't like. You know, that he wants to make tidier, but, you know, he's a perfectionist. And, you know, Spring Lake is really lucky to have him. And, you know, some of the selections we made and some of the, you know, things we did were both to allow Josh to ease into what he wanted to do. Some of it we pushed Josh on to get some things done that he just simply is, you know, accepted and taken care of. Because, you know, the work we did didn't just surround bunkers. One of the things that I was really adamant about wanting to try to restore were in the greens when we were doing the bunkers around greens and the grassing and the regrassing was trying to restore these wingbacks that Tillinghast had built into the greens. And, you know,
sure.
Those that don't know what a Tillinghast wingback is, and probably most people don't, but Tillinghast would carry his greens up into the corners of his greens, would carry the collars up so that a ball may hit a slope in the back of the, you know, back left corner, back right corner of the green and feed back to the green. And you know, we haven't done all of those yet because it's best for Josh to be able to take care of those as they're coming on. And if we'd have done all 18 greens, we would have it would have made it a little more difficult, actually a lot more difficult in
yeah.
some respects. But,
sure.
Of
course.
But it's been an outstanding, you know, it was an outstanding process. I mean, Josh and I grew through the project, and I think have a great respect for each other, and it's gone really well.
Oh, that's good. So, guys, I'm going You know, I always think, well, what am I going to talk about for 45 minutes? And then I think about the hours and hours of conversation that I've had with people on renovation and restoration. But real quick, I'm just going to bang through a couple of things here. Can I ask each of you, let's start with Josh. in hindsight, something that you didn't do or did wrong that you'd like to change or that you would do next time?
As far as things, I don't think there's anything we'd like to change. In the overall project, I don't know that there's really any one thing that we would have liked to have done different. I think on certain days, you know, as you're digging in the ground and you catch an irrigation line that's not on your as-built, stuff like that, you know, those things pop up, and maybe in the day you wish you would have done something a little different. But I think from an overall project standpoint, I mean, like I said, I've been through a few of these. I kind of had a map of how I wanted things to operate and go, and you know, we stuck pretty close to the plan, and you know, I think it went really, really well.
So,
you know, it was one of the questions I was struggling with.
So having a plan kept you from having to look back and say we really didn't do this right or whatever. That plan important. That's a key thing I think that a lot of people don't get is when you don't want to have a whole lot of hindsight opportunities, we call them, have a good plan and the foresight, you know. So
yeah,
sounds like that was your
communicating
method.
I just think it's all about like the communication before you get started, so everybody's kind of on the same page, and then just getting, you know, from a maintenance standpoint, you know, my two assistants are young guys, they're really, really good guys, you know, but they've never been through something like this, and getting them coached up and trying to have them know what's going to happen before it happens type of thing. Those types of things are just really important in something like this.
Trip, anything for you in hindsight that you might have done differently?
No, when we go back and look at the work that we did, I mean, there's really nothing that we would have done differently. I mean, there's some things that, as Josh and I talked about during the process, and then Jim Hickey, the Greens chairman that was there, we were trying to make the golf course feel more like a links course. And so given the fact that it's about a half a mile from the ocean, and you know, the original golf course there was going to be a little bit firmer and faster, you know, back in the day, especially when it didn't have irrigation. This golf course is built mostly over sand. And so Josh kind of embraced the idea of making the golf course feel a little more links-like. And so we took out a good many trees and tried to incorporate fescues in some places. I think the only thing that we've done that we're going to probably tweak a little bit is where we brought fine fescues into the bunker edges and lines of play and so forth. And you've got to try those things. I mean, that's one thing that I definitely would encourage during a renovation project is don't be afraid to try something that you may have tweak a little bit later on, but you know, you really don't. Every property is so different that you have to try little things here and there. And some of the grass lines that we put in, we may tweak a few of those over time, but I wouldn't have gone back and done it differently because I think it helps us to understand the common theme that we're working through. And, I look at architecture the same way that Josh made with maintenance. You know, there's little things that, you know, look at, but overall I think it went extremely well. It was well planned out. I don't think the membership sometimes the membership will look at little things, but from 1 year to doing this is one of the better projects we've done in terms of schedule, everything else.
So cool. And I love what you said about not being afraid to try things. I think that's such a key point, really key point. Josh, really fast, tell us about your grassing selection. What did you do on greens and everywhere else? What do you grow out there?
We have Poa greens, they're Poa bend mix, but we maintain them as Poa. Same thing with the fairways, they're Poa bend, but we're more on the Poa side, so that's what we take care of. That's coming from the places that I've come from. That's what I've known since I started working on a golf course is Poa greens. You know, obviously at Oakmont, it's a premium, and here, you know, we've done a lot of the same things. you know, like our rough selection for all the sod is, you know, turf type tall. A lot of fescue sod going in, a lot of fescue, like hydro seeded areas in some of the really big acreage type areas. Yeah, that's about it. We honestly try to reuse as much of our POA sod. If we sod cut it, we put it on plastic off to the side and ended up reusing it a lot.
Yeah, sure. And so along those lines, then, talking into agronomics, you guys ended up using Sand Trapper out there. Is that correct? And doing the lined bunker kind of thing?
That is correct. Yeah. And, you know, we did use Sand Trapper. It's what we used when we did the bunker project at Weeburn. We incorporated the Liquid Nails product. It's like a waterproof caulk, if you will, to cover up all the seams and the rolls of the Sand Trapper and all the staples. They smear it across each staple head to keep the water from getting out, to minimize the freeze-thaw effect. The product's been around since, I guess, like kind of the mid-90s. It's time-tested and proven. You know, I know there's a lot of new things out there for lining bunkers, and not to say that they don't work great, you know, but I like something that's been in the ground for a while that definitely works. And a lot of the other products, whether they're spray-on or asphalt or whatever it might be, you know, we're doing most of the work in the winter. You know, there's asphalt plants close down in the winter sometimes, and you know, if the ground's even just a little bit thawed, you can get a staple in the ground and you can lay Sand Trapper. So I think that actually helps us with timing of the project, you know, to be finished. Because we did most of our work from middle of October to 1st of April. We did two phases to finish the project. And I would say 90% of the work happened between middle of October and the 1st of April.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, that's cool. And I love what you said about the liquid nail thing. Heard that before, and I think that's going to become a commonplace practice for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so look, as we're getting close to the end of our time here, guys, let's talk for just a second. This may be a little unexpected, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts are about Chambers Bay and what you're seeing for the U.S. Open and what your predictions may be. So, Tripp, let's start with you.
Well, I actually had a chance to play it. Our American Society of Golf Course Architects annual meeting was in Seattle 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. And oddly enough, I got to play it with Mr. Jones, paired with him for that day. And so I got to hear an earful about the golf course. When I played it, the greens were really slow. So, I mean, I didn't get to see all the, you know, the contouring and so forth. You know, and I happened at lunch to get to watch a little bit of it, and it looks terrible on television.
I think we all agree.
But it's firm and fast is something that, you know, regardless of the color, is something that's very important to me as an architect from a strategy standpoint. And so I think you're going to see that, and I think that, you know, the golfing public in America gets to see firm and fast and understands the value in it. From a prediction standpoint, I think this type of golf course, you know, that golf course in particular is going to favor the long players. Just simply because there's some carry points that they can use that the average length player can't. And so, I mean, you know, it's who's to say? I think a lot of people think Mickelson's going to be there.
Yeah, I think you may be right about that. Josh, you got a prediction for who's going to win?
Prediction on who's going to win, I guess it depends on whether they play it at 73 or 400 yards or almost 8,000, I guess, as they've been talking about on TV a bunch. I don't know if they play a long hitter. Dustin Johnson, maybe somebody like that.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. That's my pick, too. So, well, guys, thanks a lot for your time. This has been the Renovation Report. I've been happy to talk with Tripp Davis and Josh Rigger, talking about Spring Lake Golf Club today. And, guys, thank you so much for being here. Look forward to hearing more about Spring Lake, and really look forward to seeing that golf course come into its own.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.